Let's talk about the future of news.
I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
The state of journalism today.
Telling both sides of a controversial story.
I think you must be unbiased.
It's honesty, fairness, truth.
That is our job. That is our job. That is our job. That is our job.
Welcome once again to the Our Man in Stockholm podcast. It's the middle of the summer and it's the best time to be in Stockholm, but usually I'm never here to enjoy it. As I report a lot on sports, there's usually a World Cup or an Olympics or a European Championships to cover. But this year, thanks to COVID-19, I'm stuck at home. I was actually due to be in Copenhagen to cover the Danes and Finland on their quest for Euro glory, but the coronavirus has put a stop to all that and more. The situation has, of course, led to much pining for the lost baggage, attempted muggings, and incomprehensible menus in exotic places that usually accompany this time of the year. And who better to discuss these things with me than Irish author and former sports journalist Paul Howard. Paul, how are you this fine day in Avoca, County Wicklow?
I'm fine. I've been for my walk. I've exercised, doing all the things that are demarcating the passing of the hours during this unending lockdown.
It's kind of like the Shawshank Redemption without the barbed wire, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's kind of like a zombie apocalypse movie, really, you know. I'm out walking and I see one of my neighbors, and my first instinct now is to give them a wide berth, you know, like in case they bite me or something. It's just, And it's very counterintuitive for me to do that, you know, to avoid someone because, I think I'm normally quite a friendly person and I hate it, you know, I really hate it. And what is it, 4 months now? I'm over it. I'm tired of it. I want to go back to normal. Yeah. I want my life back.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was actually at the Algarve Cup, which is a women's football tournament in Portugal, when this all sort of kicked off. And they couldn't even play the final because the Italian women's team had to go back before their country locked down. And then when I got back to where I live here in Sweden, I remember going into, there's a huge shopping centre near me here. And I got back from the airport. I had to go get something to eat on the way home because there was no food at home. And it was just, you know, like I say, it's like 28 days later. There was nobody around. And then you meet people. And like here, you know, especially with young lads that you might have played soccer with, you always shake hands and give them a little hug. And there's none of that anymore. And I just wonder how we're ever going to be able to relate to one another again after this, when all these things have changed, you know?
But, yeah, I mean, sports is a huge thing. I was saying this to someone the other day that, like, I've discovered during the lockdown that without sports, I don't have anything of passionate interest to argue with anybody about it. Like most of my family, my father, my friends, we tend to agree on all the important stuff, you know. Yeah. We'd have a very similar kind of moral compass about things. So there hasn't been kind of raised voices or anything on the phone, like when I'm talking to my dad, for instance, you know. Yeah. And then when the football came back during the week, he's a Spurs fan.
God love him.
It's one of the things that can still bring him to a red-faced rage is following Spurs, you know. And I wind him up and he winds me up about Liverpool. And there were raised voices on the phone again the other night. And it's the first time we've been shouting at each other since March. And yeah, it was great. It just felt great. And it just was a reminder of how much I've missed it, you know, how much I've missed football, how much I've missed, you know, having this thing that, you know, it drives you to despair and drives you to ecstasy. And it's just been a huge hole in my life for the past few months.
Yeah, now that you mention that, I think I've spoken to my own father about once since this started, because literally all we talk about is football or hurling or rugby or tennis or and whatever, because our relationship has always been built on, like, you know, 90% of it would be that and 10% would be the other stuff that he actually taught me to turn me into, you know, whatever sense of a man I ever became. But I must give him a call because we're actually speaking on Father's Day. So, and of course then the Merseyside Derby is today. He's an Everton fan. So I'll have to call him before that all kicks off. But, are you a man for sporting nostalgia at all, Paul? Because the newspapers have been sort of filled with Italian 90, which was great for the Irish soccer team, and USA 94 for the Swedes where I live. Have you enjoyed any of that at all? Or, you know, would you prefer sort of new content, as the kids would have it?
I think I haven't really enjoyed it, because I like nostalgia, but I like it. I like it alongside something else. Like, I like it alongside something kind of modern day. Yeah. For me, it's just been like, nostalgia for me is the side salad, and I have to have my main meal. And I've just been eating nothing but side salad since March. I like nostalgia. I suppose the older you get, the problem with nostalgia is the older you get, the faster the time goes. And it just doesn't seem that long ago since we were discussing 25 years since Italia 90. And I remember 20 years since Italia 90. I remember 10 years since Italia 90. So every, you know, the gaps in between those bouts of nostalgia get closer and closer together. So I think anybody who wasn't around for Italia 90, I think it's great for them to listen to all the podcasts, watch the programs, read the articles. There's been dozens, hundreds of them. And I've actually got to write one myself tomorrow, believe it or not, for the Irish Times.
The bills have to be paid.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, I like the nostalgia, but not when it's just nostalgia. And I kind of understand, like, that it has to, that's the way it had to be for the past few months. But it's just great to have, you know, modern day things to argue about now. You know, that's the issue with nostalgia, especially for Italia 90, was that it wasn't half as good as we remember it. And I'm talking about as a sporting event. It was a huge thing, in relation to Ireland's, social development, I think. You know, we were definitely a different country in the 70s and the 80s, when we had all those terrible decisions given against us in qualifying matches that cost us, you know, qualification to certainly the 1982 World Cup and probably one or two other tournaments as well. And then suddenly under Jack Charlton, we started to get those bounces, things started to go for us. And you know, I've read loads and loads of people saying that it was the start of the Celtic Tiger, the Italia 90. I'm not sure if that's true, but it certainly changed what it was. You know, it changed our sense of Irishness for a lot of us. For me, definitely, it changed my sense of Irishness, especially going out into the world where suddenly when you told people you're from Ireland, they didn't instantly say, you know, Guinness or U2. Like, we actually had, we had, you know, something sporting to be proud of.
Or the IRA, for that matter, because of what was going on at that time.
You
know, yeah?
Or where you live, that kind of thing. It changed a lot of perceptions about Ireland, but it certainly changed mine, you know. Up until then, it had just been hard luck stories and, you know, the poor put upon Irish. And then suddenly it changed. And there was a great summer as well. That was the thing about Italia 90. The weather was great. I was young. I was 19, and I think I preferred Euro 88, though.
Yeah.
Because Euro 88 was new. The ole, ole, ole thing hadn't really happened in earnest. You kind of got a sense with Euro 88. Anyone who was there following the team were actually there for the football, yeah, not for crack, you know. I used to go to Lansdowne Road throughout the 80s, and you know the matches would be on a Wednesday afternoon because there was no floodlights in Lansdowne Road, so matches had to be played at about 2:30 on a Wednesday afternoon, and quite often there'd be like 14,000 people there, you know, unbelievable, like empty, and like at halftime you just go up to the we used to go up to the stewards who were manning the upper west stand or the upper east stand at halftime and say, will you let us up, mister? They'd let you up just empty out of the terrace, and they'd let you sit in the seats for free because the place was empty. Yeah. And then, you know, I suppose with success, the crowds came. But I kind of still loved that time, you know, the qualification for Euro 88 and the tournament itself. And the fact that we actually won a match at Euro 88 made it special as well. Like Italia 90 was just a bunch of draws.
They were terrible games.
Constantly celebrating draws. And somehow we got we got into a situation where we were, whatever it was, 20 minutes away from the semi-final. You know, it's but I didn't feel the same joy definitely with Italia 90.
Yeah, it was a weird tournament in that way, because we felt that we finally sort of arrived, you know. But I think, as you say quite correctly, the Euro 88, it was all new. It was kind of, you know, the football people, in inverted commas. I was actually speaking on a Swedish podcast recently about that, and I remember working in the Badass Cafe, which was a pizza restaurant Temple Bar. I was washing dishes when England played Ireland, and when Ray Houghton scored that goal, I just left and I never went back. And I kind of wonder to this day, could I still turn up and go, "Oh, lads, I'm back now"? Is my job still there waiting for me, you know?
But they've been still paying you since then, have they?
No, very much not. And they probably shouldn't have even been paying me then. Jesus, I was hopeless. My heart wasn't in it, but at least we had the radio up in the show so you could listen to Ray Houghton put the ball in the English net. But in the beginning there, Paul, you were saying you were 19 at Italia 90 when this all happened. What was the first major sporting event that you actually got to cover? And is that the kind of thing you dreamed of doing when you were watching Italia 90?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I dreamed of covering a World Cup when I was a kid. You know, like, I suppose Argentina 78 is the first World Cup I remember.
Me too.
I think Spain 82 was the first World Cup I was really engaged by, because I was 11. I heard somebody say that the best, your favorite World Cup is always the one you watched when you were 11. And that was mine. It was, you know, I remember, I still have it actually. I had a copybook. And I started covering all the matches, like, you know, like as a little kind of 11-year-old boy reporter. And I was, you know, when Belgium played Argentina in the first match, I wrote out the teams, wrote out the score, the scorer, the minute the goal was scored in, little incidents in the match. I wrote a little report and all the rest, you know. And I did it for every match in that tournament, which was, I think, 52 games. And my mother kept it, actually. And I didn't know she kept it. I had the Spain 82 logo written on drawn on the cover of this copybook. And my mom kept it. And then when I covered my first World Cup in Japan, Korea, in 2002, she gave it to me just before I went. And it was 20 years later, you know. So it was a really special thing. But I did. I obviously wanted to, you know, given how much work I actually put into these reports, and they're all written in that kind of John Motson type language, like, you know, he finished with aplomb, all that kind of thing.
We didn't even know what aplomb was.
No, I had no idea what aplomb was. But, you know, that kind of, that language that I think came out of services radio after the war, you know, that Barry Davis and John Motson, they used to talk like that, you know, like kind of like they were kind of officers in the army, you know, finished with aplomb.
Yes.
So it was written on that. But I think I must have known then, if I was doing that, like, that I wanted to be a sports reporter. And for me, being a football fanatic, the ultimate for me was covering the World Cup. When I got there, it was
hold on now, hold your horse. I want to know, when did you find out you were finally going to get to go to the World Cup, and how did that feel?
Well, I suppose it was around 2001, September 2001, I suppose, the 1st of September. I actually do remember the exact moment. Ireland were in the qualifying group with Holland and Portugal, and it was the first two, first qualified automatically, and second place went into a playoff. And I wouldn't have given Ireland any hope, you know. I really wouldn't. I mean, actually, looking back, they had a really good team. I mean, they had Roy Keane, but you know, Gary Kelly, Ian Hart, Stephen Staunton, Shea Given, Jason McAteer, Damien Duff, Robbie Keane. You know, all at the height of their powers as well at that stage. Kevin Kilbane. But I couldn't see them qualify now, that group. And then they beat Holland at Lansdowne Road. And that was it. You know, when that happened, they just had to beat Cyprus then to get into the playoff position. They beat Cyprus. And then the playoff, once the draw was made for the playoff, I thought, you know, it was against Iran. And I thought, oh, I couldn't see Iran beating Ireland over two legs. And then so I went to Iran for that match, for the away match. And that's when it was confirmed. So I knew at that point, because I was the soccer correspondent for the Sunday Tribune at the time, I knew I'd be going to the 2002 World Cup.
And who was Vincent Brown, the editor of the Tribune at that time, or who was
Vincent was gone a long time at that stage. Matt Cooper was the editor.
All right. And did he sort of call you, just took it for granted that, right, I'm booking a ticket to Saipan or Tokyo or whatever now? Or did he sort of call you in and go, right, Paul, I'm delighted to be able to tell you you're finally going to the World Cup?
No, it wasn't one of those this is your life moments, you know. It's kind of like the thing is as well, it's, you don't really look on it like a holiday, like, you know. You wouldn't be, I mean, this sounds disingenuous, but I'm telling the truth here. When you go and cover a major tournament, whether it's an Olympics or a World Cup or a World Athletics Championships, whatever it is, it's a lot of work. You know, there's very little downtime. You know, you're lucky if you get, you know, 2 days off and the whole time you're there. What you see mostly of a country when you go away to cover an event in it is mostly you see the hotel, the media village, if there is one, the shuttle buses bringing you from, you know, hotel to media, to the event, or hotel to training. That's what you see a lot of. I always did try to parcel off a couple of days where I can actually see something, because there's nothing more frustrating coming back from, you know, some beautiful exotic location and realize you haven't seen a thing.
Oh man, at the last Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, you know the way they always, like when you go to the Olympics, they organize these sort of, you know, trips where you can visit certain places and that, but I never pay attention to those because, you know, I don't feel that I'm going to have the time. And then it turned out that, you know, the way my events were, that I actually could have gone to the demilitarized zone, which is the border between North and South Korea. And I've always wanted to see that. And by the time I went to book it, there was no places left on the bus. And it's the first time I've ever been disappointed to be somewhere, because I've been in Kiev for the Euros and I've seen the bakery, which is basically what Escape to Victory was based on. It was the story of the bakers from that particular place. I wrote the story and I talked to some of the people, and, you know, I got to do some great stories there. So I kind of felt that I'd seen most of what I wanted to see when I got there. But in South Korea, it was exactly as you say. It was, you know, buses, and it was, you know, straight to the biathlon venue and the cross-country skiing venue. So I never really felt, we didn't even see, you know, the city centers or that. We were just up in the mountains, you know. And yeah, I kind of felt a little bit sort of ripped off by that. Not ripped off as such, but the World Cup, the first World Cup I got to do was in 2014 in Brazil. And I actually got that, you have been selected. And I thought, you know, I didn't make it to 2010 in time. Denmark qualified, which is one of the teams I would have covered. But then somebody got pregnant. One of the women who was supposed to cover the World Cup got pregnant, and they just couldn't get me there in time. So I missed the 2010 World Cup in South Africa. But the first one I got to do was in Brazil, the spiritual home of football.
Now, yeah, yeah.
You know, I wasn't in Rio or Sao Paulo. I was up on the coast in Recife. But I actually had much more freedom because there was, like, less journalists there. It was, I wouldn't say there were lesser games, because there's some big teams, there's some big games there. But if you're following Brazil, I'm sure your World Cup experience would be completely different. But when you go out there, the difference, I think, between the way the two of us work is, I work for an agency, so I wrote about anything and everything. But you were there specifically to follow the Irish team. Now, I'm not sure, can you remind us of anything that might have happened at the 2002 World Cup that may have been of note?
Well, I suppose the first thing was the Tribune didn't send me to Saipan. There was a big we had a big choice to make, I suppose, because we were a Sunday newspaper, a weekly newspaper. There didn't seem any sense in sending me to Saipan. We were broke as well. The Tribune didn't have any money, never ever had any money. So they would always look to save money wherever they could. So there were two trips on offer. There was the Saipan plus the World Cup, and then there was just go directly to the World Cup. So none of the Sunday guys went to Saipan. We all just decided we were going to go straight to Japan about a week later. So we missed everything. Like, we missed the whole fallout of everything that happened on Saipan. But when we were leaving Dublin, I remember I stayed in that hotel near the airport the night before, because I was coming up from Greystones and it was a really early flight. So they just put me up in the hotel next to the airport. And I got up that morning at about 6 o'clock, and there was talk that Roy Keane had walked out. I'm trying to remember the exact chronology of what happened, but Roy Keane had said he was going home. That was it. By the time I got up that morning, he changed his mind and he was staying. There was a sort of sense, I remember getting to Dublin Airport and meeting all the other reporters who were going out there, and there was a sort of sense that this wasn't the end of it, and he might possibly have regretted his decision to stay. I remember having a sense of that. And our stopover on the way to Japan was in Amsterdam. So it was kind of really short haul flight to Amsterdam and then a long flight to Tokyo. And it was when we got off the plane in Amsterdam, we all turned our phones on, that we got the news from home that Roy Keane had gone home, we basically crossed in the air somewhere over Russia, I think.
And that, of course, for non-sports fans listening, or for non-Irish people listening, this was basically Ireland's sporting civil war, where the captain wasn't happy with the situation, the training pitches, this kind of thing, and decided, no, I'm going home. So there was a big bust up with the manager, and people said things, and you know, they may have regretted them, they may not have, and he ended up leaving. So he was also Ireland's best player and one of the greatest midfielders of his generation. And you're going out there to cover this thing, and all of a sudden, Ireland's best player, the captain, in fact, is on a flight home when you're on your way out there.
Yeah, the whole World Cup was Ireland's World Cup was framed around Roy Keane. I was actually writing a book which was going to come out in the September after the World Cup about Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy's relationship. And I got the idea for this book when I saw them shake hands after the Ireland-Holland match at Lansdowne Road, where they could barely even look at each other. They're sort of looking in. Well, Roy Keane couldn't bear to look at McCarthy. Like, they were sort of shaking hands, and Keane is looking at this moment of glory where Roy Keane has brought Ireland to right onto the threshold of the World Cup, and obviously Mick McCarthy as well, but they couldn't enjoy it together. And I thought it was a really chilling image. And actually, I probably knew at that stage that there was trouble to come, because I pitched a book that September, this September 2001, to the O'Brien Press, and eventually was published under the title The Gaffers.
Yeah.
But I thought that the substantial part of that book was going to be written at the World Cup, observing Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy and how they were around each other. And of course, now Roy Keane is going home. So it kind of put a dampener on everything, really, you know. But it also stopped me enjoying the World Cup. You know, it was the only World Cup I ever got to cover. And I didn't really enjoy a day of it until Ireland went out.
Yeah.
And that was the truth. Because, you know, I would be ringing home and my dad would say, oh, did you see... You know, you see Portugal got beaten, you see France got beaten, all these shocks, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't see any of those matches. I didn't, like, not even on television. I watched England, Argentina on television. We'd been flying the night before, and I fell asleep in the second half, fell asleep for the whole second half, you know, because we'd had a flight. And that's how I remember the World Cup. I got to see Ireland's four matches. And then I got to see a quarterfinal, a semi-final, and the final. So I saw seven games, and I might have seen three on television. So I really feel like I missed that World Cup. And a few years ago, I bought a DVD of all the goals of the 2002 World Cup. And honest to God, most of them I was seeing for the very first time. I'd never seen them. I had no memory. I had no conception of that World Cup, because I was too close to it. Like, Conhoolan has had a great line about Italia 90. He said, I missed Italia 90. I was there.
Yeah.
And that's what it is to cover a tournament. You're too close to it. So our day-to-day was going to training, going to press conferences, you know, at which the first 20 questions were about the possibility of Roy Keane coming back, you know? And it was clear that, you know, Mick McCarthy didn't want him back, the players didn't want him back, that the FAI, somebody in the FAI was pushing this agenda to get him back. And then also, because of the way because of the way the row happened between Roy Keane and Mick McCarthy, it came from two newspaper articles, one by Tom Humphreys and the later one by Paul Kimmich. But at that point, only the Tom Humphreys article was in the public domain. Yeah. And this is what caused the row between Mick McCarthy and Roy Keane. But suddenly, the press were the enemy. You know, the players who we had been quite friendly with, or who, you know, we had good working relationships with, suddenly looked on us as they were hostile to us. They didn't want to be seen to be, you know, smiling or saying hello to us at training. So there was a real them and us divide between the players and the press. So it just made it difficult to get quotes. Couldn't get one-on-one interviews. You know, the players just weren't into it. So sometimes they'd be kind of pushed into a room and forced to talk to the Sunday papers, say six or seven journalists from the Sunday papers, but they didn't want to be there. You know, so it took all the joy out of it, out of the World Cup, out of covering the World Cup, put it that way.
Mm. I remember last summer I spent with the Norwegian women's national team at the World Cup in France, and it was an eerily similar situation, because 2 years ago, the best female player in the world, Ada Hegerberg, had decided she wasn't going to play with Norway anymore. And they'd been through that, and the grieving Saipan-style process of all this, and everybody knew she wasn't going to come back, right? But then when the media arrived in France, and I was working for FIFA as a digital content producer with the team, so I was traveling with them, I was staying in the same hotels, so, you know, you were talking to these girls every day. And the same thing happened there, that the same questions were being asked again and again and again. And it was, to them, it was a non-story. Mm. And it got to the point where they didn't want to talk about it. And I always think it's really sad. Now, they were the most open team I've ever seen, Paul, because every day, during the group stages, every day, all 23 players were available to the media. And you just never see that anymore, you know. Like, now it's gone very much towards, it's kind of like the Premier League. One, maybe two might stop in a mixed zone. You're never going to get to sit down during a tournament one-on-one with somebody. But these girls did it, and it was brilliant. And the coverage they got back home in Norway, I understand Norwegian. I saw the coverage, and it was absolutely excellent. But when it's the other side of the coin, when you're there in Japan, and you're trying to write, and you have, like, you know, one shot pretty much every week, right? How many articles would you be writing for the Tribune every week? Would you deliver sort of two or three pieces?
Oh, they got their money's worth. You know, Tribune insisted on getting their money's worth. I mean, I think I was writing probably about, you know, 7,000 or 8,000 words a week out there.
The Paul Howard supplement.
Yeah, but we went up, and the pagination of the paper went up. I think because whenever there was Ireland were involved in the World Cup, advertising went through the roof, so that meant the paper was bigger, and so we had a lot of pages to fill every week. And I covered the World Cup. Dave Hannigan was out there with me as well, my colleague. But the thing about that tournament in particular, it was the first one where there was kind of rolling news. Mm. So France 98, you know, you had your daily news. You know, you'd write something. The Daily guys had put something out, and then you'd read. People would read it the following morning. Hmm. 2002 was the first World Cup where you kind of had a sense that there was no longer any lag time between a story breaking and the world finding out about it, right? Yeah. So there was no chance of something happening in relation to Roy Keane and Saipan and it holding till the following day. You know, it was everything was instant. It was up on the PA wires. It was on the internet, it was a World Cup that where the news coming from it was a minute by minute thing. The Daily guys were frustrated because they couldn't get stories to hold overnight. So imagine how you felt if you were a Sunday writer, and you're a Sunday newspaper writer who doesn't have any access to players because that was kind of shut down. You know, it was kind of corporatized, and it was kind of. You know, in the lead up to it, it was difficult to get interviews because you essentially had to go through sponsors, you know, and mention sponsors' names. And I always hated that. Like, but I remember when we got there, everything is kind of roped off, you know. So there was an interview we did with Gary Breen. That was it. We were kind of getting frustrated there, you know, because we weren't getting any one-on-one interviews. So Brendan McKenna, who was the FAI press officer at the time, arranged an interview for us with Gary Breen. And Gary, I knew Gary going back, like, you know, I interviewed him quite a few times over the years, and I had a good relationship with him. And so there's 10 of us sitting around a table and we're talking to him, and he opened up, like, and he was fantastic. And like, Gary was sick when he was younger. Gary had a problem, I think it was with his spine, and there was a chance he wasn't going to be able to walk. So, you know, the fact that he actually had this professional football career and got to play in a World Cup was a big deal. And he talked to us quite a lot about that during the interview. So we all thought we had this for Sunday. And within an hour, somebody in the group, we never found out who, had given the quotes to PA. The story was everywhere. So just from a working point of view, it was a very, very frustrating World Cup to cover. Really kind of infuriating, to be honest.
Did that sour the experience for you, Paul? Because you've grown up 11 years of age, you're covering all the games, possibly better than you ever had the chance to do in 2002. When you came home and sort of summed up your experience there, were you disappointed by it?
Not really, because I think by that stage I knew what it was to cover a tournament, you know? Yeah. Like, if I wanted that big tournament experience, I would have gone as a fan.
Yeah.
But I think when you're a professional journalist, I'd been the Tribune's chief sports writer for about 7 years at that stage. I knew it was work. Like, you know, you don't go out there thinking, I'm going out here for fun. I think because I covered things like the Michelle Smith case, and, you know, the Stephen Roach story, you know, with the doping inquiry in Italy, I think I had long since ceased to be a fan. And this happens with a lot of people who cover sport. Now it's great because I haven't been a sports writer for about 15 years, and I can actually get passionate about things now and get excited about things. But to me, it was a job, and I was going out to the World Cup knowing that it was work. I didn't think I was going out there to watch lots of football and enjoy it and come home, you know, having had a great time. It's like the first international event I ever covered was, I covered the, I think it was the European Swimming Championships in 1997 in Seville. And that was the first kind of tournament, you know, kind of event, multi-nation event I covered.
Yeah.
And that was an eye-opener for me because I just realized how much work there was in it. And, you know, and that it was work and that you weren't there to watch lots of great sports. You're there to do a job. So yeah. I didn't really have any illusions about what the World Cup was going to be like, but Roy Keane coming home kind of really took any kind of pleasure out of the experience that I might have had.
I remember, like, I always dreamed of, there were certain things I dreamed of doing, you know, Olympics and World Cups, that kind of thing, but I always dreamed of covering fights in Las Vegas. And the first chance I got to do that was when Conor McGregor was supposed to fight Rafael Dos Anjos for the lightweight title in the UFC. And I'd booked as a freelancer to go, so I'm risking my own money on this and thinking there's going to be enough interest anyway. And Dos Anjos got injured. And I went, oh, fuck. Yeah, and you're in the hole for thousands here now, you know?
Yeah,
it's not going to be a title fight. And this, and they put him in against a guy called Nate Diaz. And I thought, okay, this might be something. Now, as it turned out, it was the first time Conor ever lost in the UFC. And it was a huge story. And it went on for months afterwards. And eventually he won the lightweight title and he beat Diaz in a rematch and all these things. So, but I remember at the time getting that news that Dos Anjos was out, you know, because I think he broke his foot in training. I went, ah, fuck. You know, big dream of being in the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. Have you been to Vegas? Have you covered stuff there?
I have, yeah. I've covered fights in Vegas. But exactly the same thing happened to me as you described there, except I didn't have a happy, it didn't have a happy ending for me. When I was a freelance, I went to Hong Kong to cover a Steve Collins fight. And he was supposed to fight a guy called, I think his name was Ronnie Beasley. And the event was called High Noon in Hong Kong, and Frank Bruno was on the bill, Tommy Morrison, a few others, but Steve was on the bill. And so I same as you, like, I kind of spent whatever money I actually had. It was the only money I had at the time, on a flight and kind of a hotel and flight package, and I flew to Hong Kong. And when I got to Hong Kong, I realized that first thing I realized was this package had been slightly oversold to me. They'd said it was a hotel, and I was staying in this hostel. It wasn't even on Hong Kong Island. It was on Kowloon, up in the mountains. And it was this old former army hostel, and I was sleeping in a camp bed with, like, in a dormitory with like seven or eight other strangers. I didn't know, no idea how to get into Hong Kong Island or anything. And so we walked out because we just said to the tour operator, we're not staying here. We were told we were staying in a hotel. So we walked out. The tour operator eventually found this crummy little 3-star hotel for us on Hong Kong Island. But it got worse because the following day, the fight was cancelled. That whoever was supposed to pay the fighters, the money hadn't come through, and all the fighters pulled out. So we had to leave. So, and we were like, I'd paid for this package for 5 nights or something, you know? Yeah. So we came home, and the fight was rearranged for, now I was covering it for like 8 papers or something. And like, not, I was doing it for a couple of radio stations and about 8 papers. And then we came home having, I lost a fortune. And then about 8 weeks later, the fight was rescheduled for Boston. And I managed to get the money together to go to Boston. And the fight was then canceled in Boston because Steve Collins got sick.
Oh, so
it wiped me out financially. Like, it was completely broke. But, you know.
Have you spoken to Steve since?
Oh, yeah, loads of times. I did Steve Collins' book after that. I mean, I suppose that was the good... I mean, that was one of the good things that came out of it.
In fairness, he owed you that.
Yeah. Well, I suppose I was the closest of any reporter to Steve because of that, because, you know, because I traveled around the world. I'd been to quite a few of his fights at that stage, including in when he fought for the middleweight title in New Jersey against Reggie Johnson in 92. So I suppose that, because he'd seen me at so many fights, we got to know each other quite well. And so he asked me to do his autobiography. So it was the first book I wrote. So I suppose that was my entree into the kind of the writing world, into the publishing world.
Yeah. I actually did an event with him in London. I got him to speak to a bunch of salespeople back in the day, and he's some brilliant stories. And he's, when you just give him a microphone or give him, you know, the floor and let him speak, he's a fascinating guy. And luckily I've been able to sort of keep in touch with him. He was supposed to, I think, one of McGregor's fights anyway, he was supposed to be over in Vegas. I can't remember if it was Mayweather or whatever, but I can speak to him on the phone occasionally, and he's just an incredible fella. But they are the risks you take as a freelancer, right, when you decide to go to these places. Was that the worst experience you had as a freelancer? Answer financially?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, the first fight I ever covered, like, outside of Ireland, I went to Steve Collins's fight against Reggie Johnson for the WBA middleweight title. And that the flight, my parents bought me the flight to New York for my 21st birthday party, for a present instead of a party. I asked for a flight to New York. So I was, you know, and that worked out quite well because I covered it for probably 6 or 7 papers, I think. But it's always a risk when you do that. I was lucky because, you know, I stayed with friends in New York, and the flight was paid for. So anything I made in that was mine, you know, but I was so green going over there. Like, you know, I'd never been outside Ireland and England in my life, like, you know. And I was 21, and I went over, and I was at the press conference. Steve booked me into the Meadowlands Hilton Hotel just while the fight was on for about 4 nights, I think it was. He got me a rate, which was very decent of him. And one of the press conferences was at the Brendan Byrne Arena, which is next to the Giant Stadium. And this is how green I was. I went to the press conference. I'm filing for about 6 or 7 papers on the phone afterwards, right? Reverse the charges, talking to a copy taker, because this is the days before, you know, you could actually send words down the phone line using your laptop. So I'm actually top of the head, a few notes scribbled on a notebook, top of the head, dictating a report down, 6 or 7 reports down the line to copy takers. So it's about 2 hours after the press conference. By the time I finish, all the buses and everything going back to the hotel are gone. But I look, and in the distance, I can see the Meadowlands Hilton Hotel. So I stopped somebody and said, how long will it take me to get to Meadowlands Hilton? And he said, it's only about 5 minutes. So I said, which way do I go? And he said, I'll just go down the ramp there, and it's out, and, you know, straight ahead. So I follow his instructions. What I didn't realize was he thought I was in a car.
Yeah.
So I start walking, and suddenly I find myself on a freeway, right? And there's a kind of grass for a little bit. It was like being on the sort of Stillorgan-Jewell carriageway or something for a bit. Like there's a kind of grass median, and I'm walking along the grass median, and then it just sort of comes to a point and disappears. And suddenly I realize I'm on this, like, you know, this freeway with like five or six lanes of traffic on either side, and people are screaming out their windows at me, "Are you fucking crazy?" and then I turned back and went back to I got a taxi back. But that's how naive I was. Like, you know, I'm out in the world, and that was my first kind of major event, like, to cover for as a freelance.
Yeah, but I think when you leave a place like Dublin that doesn't even have an underground system or that kind of thing, and like the Dublin we grew up in, because you're maybe a year older than me, like, you take for granted that you can walk anywhere. We didn't have, you know, the Stillorgan-Jewell carriageway. There was still like a footpath or a sidewalk that you could walk down. We'd never seen anything like these things before, even at the age of 20. You've seen them on the TV, but you don't think, when you see something of the difference, I do the same. Like, any city I arrive to cover these things, I like to walk. So, you know, and the way I get the feel of the city is that, you know, if you get the underground in, or the subway into, you know, Times Square or whatever, walk around, find your bearings, do these things, you know, drink in the atmosphere of the city. So it's only natural. So, and I've done the same thing as you several times, you know, walking onto freeways, or, you know, driving in places where I absolutely should not drive, favelas in Brazil and this kind of thing, you know. But can I ask you, which Olympics did you do? You did the one in 96 in Atlanta, right?
No, I didn't do Atlanta. I covered that from here.
Okay.
Johnny Waterson was in Atlanta for the Tribune. I did a lot of stuff about Michelle Smith and Eric De Bruyne from here, and I went to Holland to do some research on Eric De Bruyne's background. So that's where I was in the summer of 96. I covered the Sydney Olympics in 2000, and I covered the Athens Olympics in 2004.
How was that? Because the Olympics is kind of special, at least with the Soccer World Cup or European Championships. It's one sport, and usually it's one team, right? But when you arrive at Olympics, right, and I'll list the things that I've covered at the Olympics now. I have covered freestyle skiing and snowboarding. I've covered aerials. I've covered biathlon. I've covered cross-country skiing. I've covered the Nordic combined event, and I've covered ski jumping, I think. Yeah. Not known on, you know, the north side of Dublin. Like, I must be the biggest winter sports fan ever to come out of the north side after seeing all those things. How did you find it when you arrived in there? Did you take, you know, was it only the Irish you were interested in? Was it only the 100 metres, Usain Bolt? What was it that you had to report on when you got there?
I suppose the toughest thing about the Olympics is you always have this sense of fear of missing out. You're always frightened that you're going to be in the wrong spot when something big happens.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, an Olympics, it's a vast thing, you know, and I remember the first Olympics I did was Sydney. I remember the media village, and I did about 15-minute walk. It's like a big, huge campus. It was like UCD or something. And I did a 15-minute walk from the little kind of, it's like a Nissen hut where I was living in the media village, to the bus stops. And there's a series of bus stops, and everyone, like, on one bus stop there's the symbol for cycling, on one there's rowing, on one there's canoeing, and those buses leave every 15 minutes for those events. So you're literally, there's like 60 bus stops, and you have to decide what bus you're getting on today. And I suppose when you go out there, your priority is, like I said, not to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, but you can kind of anticipate where the stories are going to be. Like, we knew going out to Sydney that Sonia O'Sullivan was going to be a huge story. So that's, you know, that in week two when the athletics happens, that's your big story. There wasn't a big swimming story in 2000. There was in Atlanta in 96. But so swimming is the first week of the Olympics. As I remember, Ian Thorpe and Peter van den Hoogenband were the big story in Sydney. So I remember covering those. I remember nights in the Sydney Aquatic Centre covering those swims. But then, as well as the swimming, there's other, you know, you go out to the Olympics and everybody has a kind of sense of where the big story is going to be. But then there are also small stories that need to be covered. So that Olympics, shooting, like, there's always a couple of good shooters or who are kind of interesting. We had a guy, and I'm trying to think of his name now, for in Sydney, shot for Ireland. But he was a coal man, and I interviewed him just before we went out, and I just was really intrigued by this event. It's the only Olympic event that you essentially do in your jeans. And I just thought it was a fascinating story. So I covered that. We had one boxer in 2000, and he Mick Roach, and I think he went out in his first fight, I think it was. But even so, they're kind of, it doesn't have to, every story doesn't have to end in a gold medal. You know, it can be quite an interesting story just for the sake of the story. You know, especially for a country like Ireland that doesn't win a lot of gold medals, you're kind of looking for an interesting angle. 2004 was different. 2004 in many ways was the ultimate nightmare for a writer at the Olympics, because we all went out there thinking that the rowing team were gonna win a medal, and it was exactly the same in 2000. Actually, in Sydney, we thought we were gonna have a rowing story in the first week, and it never happened. And then the same disappointment in 2004. So you suddenly find yourself, you're in the rowing center, and then you hear that the sailing team, somebody on the sailing team is in gold medal position, going into the last round of the sailing, and if you. You know, it's hard to actually get across how vast the Olympics is.
It's huge.
This huge, sprawling thing. I mean, you could, like, the sailing, I think, was happening something like, you know, 300 miles away from where we were. And suddenly, I remember I'm sitting in the media center with Vincent Hogan from The Independent and Roy Curtis, who I think was with The Star at the time. And we just watched the rowers, basically bottom out in the rowing. And then we get this news that the sailors are doing really well, and we have to find out the rules of sailing because we don't know. We're bluffing, you know, because you go out to an Olympics, you don't know the rules of all these sports. You have a book with you. Like, that's what everybody brings that to the Olympics.
Same book every time,
suddenly,
isn't it?
Yeah. Just in case we suddenly start doing well at shooting and you don't know anything about it. And I remember I don't think we were even Googling. I think we were just trying to find out everything we could from books. I remember Roy Curtis just shouting, "Stop this madness now."
You actually did stop the madness, because you kind of gave up doing these things. But just one last question, because I know you're a busy man, you have another call to attend to, right? But what would it take for you to come back? What event have you not done that you really, really like to go back to as a journalist?
I don't think there is anything really. No, a lot of these events we're talking about now, I want to go and see them as a fan.
Yeah.
You know, I was quite disillusioned at the end. You know, like, something happened at the Athens Olympics that really kind of broke my spirit in a lot of ways. You know, I was at the shooting, and I bought a glass of orange juice, or a little bottle of orange juice, from a stall, which was like 10 yards away from where I was sitting. And I went and I sat down, I opened it, and I got a tap on the shoulder from this woman. She was wearing the Athens 2004 gear, and she said, "You can't drink that here." And I said, "What do you mean? I just bought it there." And she said, "Yeah, but it's not, even though we sell that juice in the stadium, they're not rights holders." If you drink that here, then Coca-Cola could sue us because it's a breach of our. Yeah. So I said, "What am I supposed to do?" And she said, "Well, you have to put it in your bag." And I said, "But I've just..." Anyway, I argued with her, and she said, "If you don't put it in your bag right now, your accreditation will be stripped this afternoon to cover the Olympics." And it kind of, you dream of going to an Olympics all your life, and then that happens. lots of that kind of stuff happened in my last year. I think I was tired of writing drug stories. I mean, the Athens Olympics, we had another drug story. You know, Keane O'Connor won a gold medal, and within a few weeks was handing it back again. And, you know, I went to the Olympics. Most of the books I brought with me to the Athens Olympics were about drugs, you know, anticipating that there might be a positive test and I'd have to write about it. So I think by the end, I was just a little bit tired of it. I'd done it for about 10 years, and I had an opportunity to take a sabbatical to write Ross for a couple of years. And that was 15 years ago, and I never went back. But I mean, there's lots of sporting events I want to see. I would love to go to Anfield and see Liverpool win the Premier League, for instance.
Wouldn't everybody at this point in time?
Yeah, but I would want to see them as a fan rather than as a reporter.
I wish I could tell you that it's got better since you were told not to drink the orange juice that you just bought in the stands, but if anything, it's got worse. I don't know. This, to me, kind of feels like part one, and the next time I need somebody to talk about sport, I think we might have to tell the rest of your war stories. But for now, Paul Howard, thank you so much for talking to
me. Thanks. A pleasure talking to you. Thanks.